the assailant is more likely to be an intimate than a stranger. In spite of everything we know about domestic violence, in spite of the need for more shelters and more services, the governor's budget would reduce funding for them from $3 million in 1990 to $1.2 million in 1991. This will mean that several of the almost 70 programs formed since 1976 will close their doors in 1991. According to the New York State Department of Social Services, 12,433 women had shelter in 1990, 71% because of a lack of space. This number will grow as awareness continues to increase while resources shrink. Under Governor Cuomo's budget, 19 residential programs would close, while 35 more would experience serious cutbacks in the services they provide. This translates to possible reductions in shelter beds for women and children, fewer services for children, and less help with the maze of legal services, social service agencies, and medical services that battered women must negotiate. Crisis intervention hotlines and other types of 24-hour emergency assistance would be curtailed or eliminated. New York State currently licenses 861 beds for battered women and their children. Of these beds, 326 are in New York City. The other 535 are spread throughout the state. At least three upstate counties provide no emergency residence for victims of domestic violence. The lack of available shelter often means the difference between life and death for a woman and her children running for their lives. Let's not step backward. Let's not undo what a decade or more of hard work has provided. Let's continue to make New York safe for women and children. Shelters save lives. If they start closing and if related programs are gutted, the message we will give to battered women is no one cares. It's a message they have heard too often. And again, that's a op-ed, an opinion from the op-ed page of the New York Times. Written by Gwen Wright, who is the executive director of New York State Coalition Against Domestic Violence. And we used to get their newsletters and their mailings at my former place of work, and they do good stuff. So that's an unfortunate bit of what's going on in New York State. Now, let's hear some good news from New Jersey. This is an article entitled Strengthened Domestic Violence Act Goes to Assembly by Donna Leusner. The first major overhaul of the state's 10-year-old Domestic Violence Act, designed to offer greater police protection to more victims, was sent to the Assembly yesterday after release from its Judiciary Committee. And again, an aside, yesterday means Thursday, February 21st, because this is an article from Friday, February 22nd. Widely supported by women's groups, the New Jersey State Bar Association and the State Department of Law and Public Safety, the measure is based on recommendations from prosecutors, victims, abusers, psychologists, and service providers who testified in public hearings held by the Advisory Council on Domestic Violence. The council was concerned that piecemeal amendments had confused enforcement agencies and had not had the desired effect of increasing protections for victims because of conflicts with existing procedures and inadequacies in the system to absorb the changes. Melanie S. Griffin, executive director of the Commission on Sex Discrimination in the Statutes, told the committee. The revisions provide clear guidelines and incorporate a lot of the standard operating procedures in the counties that are the best in enforcing domestic violence laws, Griffin said. Police have filled in the gaps in some counties by saying, we don't know what the law is, but we will fill in the gaps with standard operating procedures. Now everybody will know what the rules are. More than 50,000 complaints seeking protective orders were heard in family court last year or granted in municipal court, Griffin said. 90% of the victims are women, she added. Sponsored by Senator Winona Lippmann and Assemblywoman Marlene Lynch Ford, who chairs the Judiciary Committee, the measure would expand the definition of a victim to include gay and lesbian couples, the elderly, disabled, and unrelated persons, such as caretakers or housemates sharing the same residence. The version passed by the Senate deleted the reference to gay and lesbian couples, and the bills must now return to the Senate for concurrence, with several changes made by the Assembly Judiciary Committee. Another provision not included in the Senate version would amend the state's firearms law to allow police to seize a firearm when responding to a domestic violence dispute, regardless of whether the weapon was used at the time. It also would prohibit a defendant convicted of domestic violence from owning any firearms. The bill would also expand the definition of domestic violence to include homicide, terroristic threats, and criminal trespass. It also would expand the situations in which police responding to a domestic violence complaint would be required to arrest the aggressor. Under the bill, police would be required to make an arrest if they had probable cause to believe a protective order had been violated. Current laws give police discretion on whether or not to arrest someone who apparently has violated an order to stay away from another household member. The bill would continue the existing requirements that police arrest the aggressor if the victim exhibits signs of injury, but gives police additional guidance in such situations. Even in the absence of visible injuries, the police would be instructed to consider a victim's complaint of pain and consider other relevant factors in determining whether to make an arrest. The bill also would require police to make an arrest if there is probable cause to believe a weapon had been used, a restraining order has been violated, or if an arrest warrant is outstanding. In other cases, police would continue to have discretion whether to make an arrest. It also would require the Police Training Commission and the Administrative Office of the Courts to develop uniform curricula to train their members. Several other provisions appear to be aimed at preventing a repeat of the kind of tragedy that occurred in 1988 when a man arrested for threatening to kill his wife was released on greatly reduced bail and used court documents to find her. The man then killed his wife and her mother before taking his own life. Those new provisions would require that the location of a victim of domestic violence be kept confidential and not appear in court documents. They further provide that once bail is set or a motion filed to modify or dissolve a domestic violence protection order, a judge other than the one who originally heard the case would not be allowed to reduce bail or change a restraining order without knowing why the first judge set a bail high or granted the enforcement order. So there is some good news. I don't know whether or not that bill was passed. I don't know what its present status is, but at least that is an outline of what the changes would have been in New Jersey, the Domestic Violence Act in the state of New Jersey. That was from the Newark Star-Ledger of Friday, February 22nd, 1991. It was written by Donna Leusner. My next piece is a short little, well, short, article from the, I believe it's the front page of the New York Times, from February 19th, 1991. Maryland's governor to free women who killed abusers. Governor William D. Schaefer of Maryland today commuted the prison sentences of 8 women convicted of killing abusive men, saying he was convinced that the women had acted in self-defense. The women are serving sentences of 3 years to life for convictions on charges ranging from voluntary manslaughter to first-degree murder. They could be freed as early as Wednesday. Some of these stories are hard to believe, difficult, horrible stories, the governor said today. We think that after a thorough review, it's the right thing to do, he said of the decision, and they have served enough time. In a similar act late last year, Governor Richard F. Celeste of Ohio granted clemency to 26 women just before he left office. All had been convicted of killing or assaulting husbands or companions. Mr. Schaefer's decision was lauded by the United States Representative Constance A. Morella of Maryland, a Republican who last month urged Governor Schaefer to visit women imprisoned on such convictions. We can't really seek peace on earth if we can't have peace in one's home, said Ms. Morella. Ms. Morella, who had led a drive in Congress to strengthen laws against domestic violence, said the commutations today would give hope to battered women across the state. Last month, Governor Schaefer, a Democrat in his first year of his second four-year term, visited several of 25 inmates at the women's prison in Jessup, southwest of Baltimore. The women were serving sentences for killing husbands or companions they contended had repeatedly abused them. Maryland's legislature has repeatedly rejected proposals to allow abuse to be used as a defense, and state courts have not created such a right. So there's something to note in Maryland, a more liberal view of women who do fight back, and after they can no longer take it. Here is a piece from a periodical called Response to the Victimization of Women and Children, which is a very good periodical that again came across my desk at the last place I worked. And this is called World Developments in Nursing Practice and Violence Against Women. It's written by Phyllis Stern, who is an editor of Healthcare for Women International and Counsel General of the International Council on Women's Health Issues, which is an organization that's based in Canada. Worldwide, three themes persist in violence against women. One, men are stronger than women and can get away with it. Two, women's social status places them in inferior, powerless positions. And three, the cultural beliefs of many societies condone or allow the violence. Violence can be blatant, battering, rape, and murder. Violence can be subtle, as in female circumcision, allowing more work for women and more food for men, medical research, and technological childbirth. These latter practices are not intended to do violence. Rather, they follow the cultural rules of society. They are carried out with the intention of doing the right thing. Statistics are scarce on the incidence of violence against women. For the few facts we do know, we generally rely on global conferences on family violence of the United Nations held in 1975, 1980, and 1985. One of the lessons learned at these conferences is that it is wrong to assume that countries outside the United States have little or no family violence just because there are no scholarly or journalistic discussions of violence in those countries. Fatima Amin of Match International Center in Ottawa, Canada, writes that violence against women is not limited to any one country. The acts range from battering, incest, assault, and rape worldwide, dowry deaths in India, and militarization in the Philippines. In Canada, the Canadian Advisory Council on the Status of Women reports that one out of every 10 Canadian women will be abused or battered by her partner sometime during the relationship. In most of the world, women hold positions of lesser power than those of men in terms of making money, political decisions, and the ability to inherit. Joycine Boyle, in her 1985 article in Healthcare for Women International, reports that in a Guatemalan colonia, women grow up taking care of men, waiting on their needs, and occasionally submitting to ill-treatment, callousness, and neglect with stoic patience and resignation. Men express their dominance through wife abuse, excessive drinking, and occasional failure to provide money for household expense. Subarna Lakshmi Singh, in a 1989 report, Overview of the Girl Child in Nepal, writes, "Gender biases against the girl child begins from the moment of her birth and continues in one form or another throughout her life. She is discriminated against in all spheres of life and is denied the opportunity to develop and realize her potential. Unlike a male child, a female child has no legal right to family property. The law is silent even on her maintenance right in her natal home." Florence Mubichi of the Methodist Hospital in Maua, Kenya, writes in a letter that although conditions are improving, societal laws there predispose women to violence. Cultural beliefs have an impact on the incidence of violence against women. Rusab Vayara, a native of India, says that Hindu beliefs in the importance of the dowry means that each girl child is a liability. She represents money going out of the family instead of money coming in. However, boys receive the dowry when they marry. Dowry money and gifts are recorded and must be returned in the case of divorce. This explains in part why brides may be murdered rather than divorced. According to Jocelyn Hezekiah and Frieda Waffela in their 1989 article in Healthcare for Women International, within the beliefs of the culture, female circumcision can be viewed as a procedure intended to give a young woman the best advantage of marriageability. Pauline Mella, head of the School of Nursing, Dar es Salaam University, Tanzania, explained in a letter that the custom persists even in countries where it has been outlawed, because according to law, it is the best way to make the girl presentable. According to Chandice Harris in a chapter of the book Women, Health, and Culture, the practice is analogous to the persistence of male circumcision in other countries. Easily identified acts of violence likely happen in all countries. In Kenya, women are regularly beaten by their husbands in order to discipline them. Boyle found that 64% of the households in her sample of 134 individuals in a Guatemalan colony had a family member, always male, who frequently drank excessively, becoming abusive or threatening with his spouse. Mars reports that in Nicaragua, half the women who reported being beaten by their partners suffered abuse for more than 1 year before laying charges. And in the Philippines, rape by members of the Philippine military is escalating. Subtle violence against women happens when the culture says that's the way it's supposed to be. Less food and more work for women is clearly appropriate when men are seen as more important, more blessed, and the ones who protect women from rape, assault, and battery by other men. Subtle violence against women can be found in most birth rooms in the civilized world, and increasingly in developing countries as technology distorts the birth process. Culturally sanctioned violence can come in the form of medical research. A startling example was reported by Sandra Coney and Felita Bunkel in their 1986 article in Metro, a popular New Zealand magazine, and in Coney's 1988 book, An Unfortunate Experiment. Herbert Green, associate professor at Auckland's National Women's Hospital, was an expert in cervical cancer, according to Coney and Bunkel. Women there were involved in an experiment without their knowledge. Over a 20-year period ending in 1982, 25 women with a positive biopsy for cervical cancer were left untreated so that the natural course of their disease could be studied. These women knew they were involved in a research project, but they were never informed of the nature of the experiment. After Coney and Bunkel blew the whistle, a national inquiry was initiated, but not before 23 of the 25 women left untreated had developed invasive cancer. While research on violence against women worldwide is sparse, action has begun. At the 4th International Congress on Women's Health Issues, a full day was devoted to reports on organized action in response to violence against women. Amelia Mange Maglakas, chief nurse to the World Health Organization, stressed that to be effective, nursing action needs to be combined with the efforts of other disciplines and must be aimed at empowering the target population. Nurses at the Violence Against Women Seminar of the Midwest Research Conference in Indianapolis, Indiana, April 22, 1990, agreed that nursing research and practice against violence worldwide must be in conjunction with other professionals, lay workers, and women of the country. It must be undertaken in partnership with the target group, women, and must lead to the empowerment of the women themselves. More importantly, research or practice must follow pioneers in the field and lend nursing's special perspectives grounded in practice. And that was from the periodical entitled Response to the Victimization of Women and Children, Volume 13, Number 2, a piece by Phyllis Stern called World Developments in Nursing Practice and Violence Against Women. Just to let you know that it does indeed go on in other areas of the world, and usually in more, at least to us, horrific ways, female circumcision and the rest. And violence is a lot more condoned culturally in a lot of other cultures and countries. And it's also less easy to bring charges and to seek justice for these particular things. Let me play one song, go to some music here. Kate Bush, a cut called Love and Anger from her newest, I believe it's her newest, The Sensual World. At almost 6 o'clock, it's 5:53, almost 5:54. Now it's 5:54 in the morning, Sunday morning. You're listening to Heresy, and my name is Sharon Griffiths. Here's Kate Bush.
Take me all my life.
Kate Bush from her album The Sensual World, as she says, because she's English. And she's gorgeous, and she sings well, and she writes very well. And that was called Love and Anger. I found, as I did last week, when I did my dream show, I found, going through my collection, that a lot of women have songs on their albums, whether written by them or not, that deal with anger and anger targeted against them and such, as they also have many songs about dreams. So one is a positive and empowering part of being a female, which is living in a dream world, or being able to translate dreams into creative reality. And the other part is an unfortunate marking of a problem that has been experienced by many, many, too many of us. Now, what I have to read next is pieces from segments from a book called Mejor Sola que Mal Acompañada, which means Better Off Alone Than in Bad Company. And the subtitle is For the Latina in an Abusive Relationship, Para la Mujer Golpeada. And again, pardon me for my rotten Spanish, but it's funny. A friend of mine speaks fluent Spanish. And she sometimes goes off on this little kick where she speaks to me in Spanish, won't speak English. And between my 4 or 5 years of French and her body language, we communicate just fine. I answer her, of course, in English. I just have a tremendous problem with Spanish, because I translate everything I hear in Spanish first into French and then into English. Or everything I try to say back again, I do the same thing first into French and then try to flub my way through the Spanish. And I noticed the same thing happening. It's funny how you discover your own patterns of learning as you get older. And you become aware of these things. That when I was a classical musician, a bass player. I played the double bass for 16 years. And conservatory trained and all that nonsense. And I let go of that instrument quite a few years ago, actually. Wanting never to have it darken my towels again. And I just got it out of my house and out of my life. It hasn't been sold yet. It's sitting in my my repairman's loft, waiting to be sold. So if anyone's in the market for a really wonderful instrument, and who knows a bass player, a deserving bass player who needs a really nifty instrument, please drop me a note, and I'll tell you who to contact. But one thing I did notice, I jettisoned that part of my life totally because of all the bad vibes that were associated with it. And I found that I couldn't stay away from music. I just couldn't. It was in me. It has been in me since I was 11, and that's 25 years. So I decided to take up a new instrument, and I went out and bought a cello, which is relatively similar to a bass. Of course, to a bass player, a cello looks like a little throwaway thing, you know. It's tiny compared to what I'm used to carrying around. But it has, you read the same clef, you read the same music. You get to play more, you have a much wider selection of things to play. And I'm doing it strictly for my own my own pleasure at this point in life, as I'm doing many things. There's a great poem by somebody, again going off the deep end here, called When I Am Old. I think that's what it's called, but it's something about when I am old, I will wear purple with a red hat. So as you get older, you start doing what you bloody well please. And so I'm playing my cello as a, to please myself. And something I noticed, as I noticed about my inability to speak Spanish, was that I am, if I'm taking a bit of an old